This is 88.5 KRFY Pondere. You're tuned into the Community Character Hour, coming to you on Monday, April 22nd, 2024. And let's start by looking back 110 years to May 11th, 1914. What was going on then?
The A.G. Barnes Circus came to town featuring Mrs. Emma Crane, formerly Miss Emma Van Curler of Sandpoint, who, quote, joined the circus about 2 weeks ago in Spokane and takes part in the Wild West afterpiece as one of the writers. The circus brought mayhem and mischief to town. That same day, elephants wandered across a baseball field during a game with Gonzaga, helping Sandpoint score, according to the paper. Children were also reported stealing flowers from yards.
Complete chaos that day.
Can we talk about Mrs. Emma Crane, formerly Miss Emma Van Curler of Sandpoint?
I do love that it's not stated, but she obviously ran away and got married to someone in the circus.
Immediately.
Yes.
Like, she had, as of 2 weeks ago, that's when she joined the circus. She ran away, literally ran away and joined the circus.
Probably got married the same day.
Yeah.
Yeah. I also love that, like, something that probably would not have been widely approved of, running away with a circus performer at the time. I feel like the paper is very kind to her in the way they write this.
Yes.
It's like career by change. Becoming such a magnificent performer with the circus, she has somehow like skipped through the part of running away and marrying someone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Forever saving her reputation.
Yes. Her triumphant return 2 weeks later. As part of the, what was it? As part of the Wild West afterpiece.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, thinking about, like, a girl raised in Sandpoint, you know, uncertain whether she had any experience around horses up to this point, the fact that she could be, you know, probably standing on top of a horse running around a circus ring in 2 weeks is really impressive, I think.
Does she ever show up again in the history books, as far as we know?
That's a really good question. Mm-hmm. I mean, if this same circus came to town, I imagine she would. But it was probably a blip in time. She came and went, impressed the community with her circus skills.
And apparently a man, too.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry. Yeah. And then they were on their way, traveling across the country.
Okay. And then elephants wandering across a baseball field. And apparently no casualties there. That seems very dangerous.
I also love the implication that they did not stop the game when the elephants came on the field.
Skirted
nothing
around
in
them.
The rule book says anything about elephants. Play like, ball.
Use the distraction, get six home runs in a row, and then that'll seal the score.
Sandpoint was serious about sports back then.
Mm-hmm. Yes, definitely. And anything you can do to get an edge. You're listening to the Community Character Hour. This is a monthly show that we air on the fourth Monday of the month and then rebroadcast on the second Monday of the month. Heather Upton is here from the Arts, Culture, and she is the Arts, Culture, and Historic Preservation Officer of the City of Sandpoint. Good morning, Heather.
Good morning.
And Hannah Combs, the Executive Director of the Bonner County Historical Society and Museum. Good morning, Hannah.
Good morning.
And we're here to talk mainly about history of our area. And today our focus is on what I'm going to call boosterism, sort of the idea prominent everywhere in the country about 100 years ago that small towns need to be noticed by people across the country to drive tourism, industry, population growth of all kinds. And what Sandpoint did to attract attention to itself, especially in the early days of the 20th century. That's going to be our focus. And here's how it went. Here's how they went about doing it. So I'm going to turn to Hannah. Can you kind of tell us why everybody felt it was so important to bring attention to Sandpoint, why we weren't just happy, you know, chugging around chugging away on the locomotives or sawing away at the sawmills. Why we thought we need more people here for one reason or another.
Yeah, well, like you said, the future and the success of a small town, especially out west at that time, was never certain. In the early 1900s, a lot of the economy of Sandpoint was very reliant on the success of the Humbird Lumber Company. It employed, I think, about 30% of the people in Bonner County when it was in operation. And then when it closed in the 1930s, you saw this huge loss of jobs, of income, and saw how that affected all the other businesses in town. So it was kind of dangerous to be too dependent on one specific industry or another. So things like boosterism brought all different kinds of people to the community who could contribute in different ways. They could start different businesses, from boarding houses to general stores to restaurants, all kinds of things that would build a diverse economy. And then that would give the economic future of the community a little bit more sustainability. So that was really important. Generally across the country, for these little towns where you maybe only have, you know, a couple thousand people or less, everyone, and trying to find a broad enough array of different jobs to keep the town going, mm-hmm. so that you didn't have an exodus when it was just no longer feasible to live there.
Yeah. And this was kind of, these were conditions faced everywhere, not just in Sandpoint. So there was a lot of competition. And that sparked some very creative thinking as far as how to attract attention.
Well, yeah. And I always thought it was interesting in reading that hope was the main attraction. And we had talked about that in our last episode. And I think a lot of people in Sandpoint got up probably a little competitive. And they're like, we're pretty awesome, too. Like, how do we get people to stop and engage with Sandpoint on the way mm-hmm. to hope?
Yeah.
Yeah. And if you compared the two, especially back in the day around 1900, hope was... It did have the railroad going through it, but I think you still see that today where it's this tiny little community up on the hill. Mm-hmm. The whole lake is out in front of it. It's very idyllic. Mm-hmm. And people compared it to like Switzerland back in the day. And they would go there for restive spa sort mm-hmm. of vacations, whereas Sandpoint was very industrial. That was kind of its mm-hmm. identity in those early days of development. Railroads, the lumber mill, mm-hmm. all of those kind of things. So in terms of being like attractive, mm-hmm. there were these big lumber yards and railroad yards between the town and the lake. So you didn't have that same kind of like, we're on this beautiful lake impression as they had in Hope.
That's true. And still to this day, not yeah. a lot of people have like lakefront views in mm-hmm. Sandpoint.
Yeah. Exactly.
Well, okay. So we were there. We were in competition with our very close neighbor Hope, as well as all the other small towns, really in America. This, I guess, we can start by going back to even earlier, or going back to like the World's Fair. That's the first line in the notes here. Where or who wants to take this one? As far as kind of kicking off the the story.
You know, when Hannah and I were kind of brainstorming, what were the creative things that drove people to Sandpoint? We were thinking about, you know, what was happening on a national scale. Mm-hmm. And the World's Fair is such a pivotal moment for so many communities. And to be able to hold such an attractive event that is featuring new things across the nation and the world with innovation and you know, all things new and mm-hmm. putting, you know, Sandpoint on the map. We just wanted to mention moments like that were amazing, you know, to have there. And I just have to share a little personal thing. The World's Fair really resonates with me. This is kind of a strange story, but unfortunately my grandmother lost her mother at a really young age. And then, her mother. So she was raised by her grandmother, and I'll never forget, unfortunately, her grandmother, who was taking care of her at that time, was at the World's Fair, and she got ran over and died.
Wow. Whoa.
And I was going through this like suitcase that said, you know, pictures, but it was missing like a C. Pictures.
Yeah.
And there was this archival document, and it was from the World's Fair in San Francisco. And you opened it up, and it was kind of this like fancy accordion, like kind of tourist concept. And there's just something about the World's Fair that gives me such goosebumps to think that that's part of that moment in time was so pivotal to my family history. And so anyway, I just had to share that because it's so, wow. And it talks about like, it's just a moment where history is so connective, you know, to the journey of everybody. And I just like, I think about the suitcase and the treasure that I found and then that story that carries it forth.
Yeah, and the fact that you still have that piece of archival history, which in itself was a form of advertisement to draw people to this specific place. And I think the power of the World's Fairs at that time, I usually think of the one in Chicago in the 1890s. Yeah. They were places where you could go and see things you could never have imagined before. So the innovations that were being shared in architecture and manufacturing and all of these different industries were just incredible and astounding to people. And I think the reason that a lot of these methods of boosterism were really effective at this period of time is that people were at this point where they were hungry for new information, for innovation, for excitement and new ideas.
Yeah. Was it like the Instagram before Instagram was about?
Totally. Yeah. You could go and see these samples of all kinds of different things you wouldn't normally have exposure to. And people, you know, outside of those kind of experiences had very limited exposure to new ideas. So
did the World's Fair actually ever hit? I'm sure it definitely was in Spokane, but.
So that was the World Expo.
Expo.
I think they're different, but I'm not sure how. Yeah.
Yeah.
But other things that happened here.
Yeah. So some of the ways. So, yeah, the World's Fair is kind of iconic in terms of ways to bring ideas to the masses. But this did happen on kind of a micro scale in small towns across America, too. The idea of a Chautauqua was a big one. We could probably do a whole episode on Chautauquas. Amazing. But this is where you would have visiting experts in all different fields come and give lectures on different. Sometimes they would talk about history. Sometimes they would talk about industry or just news, politics, all kinds of topics just to bring more of that national or global perspective to a small town directly.
Wasn't the first one at the Panada, right? And it was pretty early on, if I recall.
Yeah, I think the Panada last year did a throwback event to the early Chautauquas that happened there.
So amazing.
Yeah. The ways that people got new information here, the railroads brought in a lot more than people had before that. You know, politicians would visit and give stump speeches. Teddy Roosevelt was probably the most famous of those who came here and did that.
And he actually, like, just stayed in people's houses. Isn't that true?
Yeah.
On his adventures.
Yeah, we actually have a pair of binoculars at the museum that he left behind at somebody's house when he was
so
visiting.
Fabulous.
I didn't know that. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Where are these binoculars?
They are on exhibit.
Oh, they are?
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I'm going to have to track them down.
I love that, deep in the archive.
Yeah. I'm sorry. I interrupted. I'm curious about his missing glasses. But
Well, you'll have to come see them.
I will.
So things like Chautauquas, circuses even, and different performances that would come into the Rink Opera House, visiting politicians, these all brought new ideas to the community.
And Hannah, you have to talk about the Rink Opera House and where it was located, because that was amazing, the attraction that brought to our small community, and so important.
Yeah, it was a huge building for the time as well. It was situated kind of where Cochava and Alpine Shop are today. But just this really, if you look at photos, it kind of looks like a really, really big pole barn. But it was this building where they would bring in performances, a lot of vaudeville. I found one actual opera that was performed there. But even though it was an opera house, generally it was all different kinds of performances. They even played baseball inside. I don't know how they protected the windows, but it was big enough really to play baseball inside this building.
Wow. Wiffle ball, maybe. when did the rink exist, by the way? And when did it stop existing?
Roughly. Quizzing me.
Sorry.
So it would have been early 1900s. Most of that part of the town was built around, like, between 1905 to 1915. Mm-hmm. And then I don't know when it came down. I know the inkwell was there later, but that was mid-century. Mm-hmm. So,
and there's a really charming public art plaque. And it says Rink Opera House that you can see that kind of shows the location. So we're honoring that history of location today because it was so important to our community.
Cool. Over on, what is that, Church Street?
And yes.
Second-ish?
Exactly.
Second and third?
Mm-hmm.
So the Rink Opera House was showing all sorts of entertainment
the
to draw
venue.
In crowds.
Yeah, along with the Panada, which is incredible.
Yeah, which went up in 1927. Mm-hmm. That one I know because it's the upcoming centennial. So you've got entertainment coming to town to kind of to showcase Sandpoint as a as an entertainment destination, I guess, for the rural residents in North Idaho and Washington and Montana.
Yeah, but these kind of efforts, you know, whether they were organized by a sort of booster club type of group or whether they happened accidentally, mm-hmm. were happening way before Sandpoint was even an official town. So two of our volunteers at the museum, Will Valentine and Dan Evans, found this incredible piece of archival history recently from 1887. So this is when a very small number of people were living in Sandpoint. It was just 5 years after the first railroad came through. And this is what I think of as kind of incidental advertising for the community. So there was this group of very wealthy, like, doctors and lawyers from New York City who had heard about Idaho. And they decided to come out here and go hunting for the, I'm sure, mythical, gigantic beasts that they'd heard about out here. So they, it's just such an incredibly strange story. They had, one of the guys had a custom buckskin suit tailored for him for this trip.
They had to look the part.
I'm imagining it with rhinestones, but maybe, probably not.
Just fringe.
And they chartered a private train to take them out here. And so Sandpoint was one of the main places they stopped to get supplied before heading up to Priest Lake, which was their ultimate destination. Mm-hmm. So these guys went up there, they hunted for a few weeks, and then when they went back to New York, one of them wrote an account of the trip, and he hand wrote this whole book and put photos of North Idaho in it, and then he sent this, he made 15 copies by hand, and then he sent them out to different family and friends. And so this is one of the earliest examples I could find of somebody kind of promoting the area and using personal accounts to enrich that story of everything that North Idaho had to offer.
Did you also feel discovering that personal story helped enrich your understanding of the area? You know, through the photos and his encounters?
Definitely. And it's something that we are still reading. And those same volunteers are working on sort of annotating it so that we can better understand the context of it. But yes, there are some incredible photos from the early days that helped give me a better understanding of what life was like here for the Kalispell tribe, what Sand Point, like the spit of sand that Sand Point got its name from, looked like early on. So, really rich history and an incredible archive to be able to explore.
I wonder if he would ever have thought that we'd be talking about it today, that it would have landed in a museum. And you just never know,
document. In his wildest dreams, he probably thought about it. Yes.
Considering the buckskin coat, that was his hope.
Yes. I think he probably had it. Yeah, he had it in the back of his mind that he was entering the history books when he wrote that diary.
Yeah. Well, the original is held at the Yale University Rare Books Library. So he obviously, someone in his family donated it, hoping that it would be preserved forever.
He was important.
What else, before we get into kind of the early 20th century, that was 1887, mm-hmm. 20 years before the town was officially chartered. What else was going on in those kind of those super early days when it was just the railroads and...
Well, bingo. You know, railroads were kind of the entity mm-hmm. that had power and money and influence out west at the time. And they did their own form of advertising. Mm-hmm.
Yes, the Wonderland train magazines were absolutely incredible. So there were these magazines that they'd put together. They'd hire this artist, and they just were gorgeous, highly attractive archival magazines that people could pick up. And they would have features on different, you know, places that they could visit, things to do. It was kind of the early, what would you call it? Like New York, well, not New York Times, because that was early as well, but...
Yeah, kind of. But yeah, I'd say the glamour of some of those travel magazines that you still see today. Mm-hmm. And it was really brilliant, actually. They would show you photos and tell you about these incredible places around the country and the pristine beauty. Mm-hmm. But then they would all tie it into a specific passenger rail line that you could travel.
So they'd say, you have to come on our train and experience this.
Yeah. And that was I don't know too much about the success of the Wonderland magazine in influencing mm-hmm. people to travel, but it was published for a very long time. So I assume that they had a lot of success with
that. I do think it was. And I think, you know, and they can be seen at the museum and the railroad exhibit, but they were some of the most beautiful advertising that we've come across, you know, back in that time period.
Hmm. Mostly photographs or paintings or what?
Combination.
The
covers.
Kind of picturing that mm-hmm. style of, I don't know what you call that, but.
Experts on design, like the fonts were just like on par and, you know, and then there was like advertisements from, you know, different industries, which was really fun to see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the covers always featured really beautiful painted illustrations. And then inside there were photographs, which at this period of time was still kind of a big deal. Mm-hmm. I mean, photos, I think, started, I think people often cite the Civil War as one of the first times where photos were being more broadly mm-hmm. utilized, but they were still kind of novel and exciting to be able to, especially to be able to see so many in one little book at the same time.
I think about how long it would take for the photography like process. You'd have to stand there and like smile and keep your eyes open for like what, 5-10 minutes
sometimes.
And is that why they're always so like grumpy?
Yes.
Or their eyes are closed, or they have a really weird look on their face, mm-hmm. or was it just the time? You just never know.
Well, we have some wonderfully silly photos from the early 1900s too. So I think as camera technology developed, people could be more themselves as they didn't have to sit still for so long.
Mm-hmm. The Wonderland train magazines. Okay, so those were going out, and people were also like sending postcards to just their relative friends and relations.
Yeah, so. Postcards fascinate me. Mm-hmm. I've never really been into postcards because I am too long-winded for them. But
there's not enough space.
I've realized why some of the reasons why they were so important back then. Before people had telephones, you kind of had to have a way to tell your relatives that you were alive. You know, like if you're traveling from Boise to Sandpoint.
Yeah.
I remember growing up, my mom was always like, call me when you get there. And I was like, I will definitely forget, but I'll try. Yeah. But like,
and then you get like the angry mom later.
Oh, totally. Yeah. But if you're traveling, you know, 3 days by train to go somewhere, your family probably wants to know that you got there safely, because if not, what do you do? Then you panic and yeah. it could turn into a whole can of worms. So postcards were really important for just communicating where you were, mm-hmm. where somebody could reach you, that you were alive, you know, and also they were a great way for people to kind of show off to each other to say like, ooh, look where I am.
There seems mm-hmm. to be a common thread with that. That's always existed.
Yeah. Yeah. What is Instagram? But well, postcards.
And the early postcards are so fascinating too, because they weren't just like mass manufactured. Like you could put your own picture of your house or, you know, a subject matter of your family or a Christmas card on a postcard, mm-hmm. Christmas picture.
Yeah. And Dick Himes was a photographer here early on in Sandpoint who really capitalized on this niche market. He was the predecessor of Ross Hall. Ross Hall actually bought his studio when he moved here, but Dick Himes was great at creating these custom postcards. And from what I've seen, he would travel all over town, mm-hmm. set up his little tripod and take photos of whatever you wanted. And then you could get those turned into a postcard that you could then send off. So his photographs are some of the best documentation of what this community looked like and the people who lived here from that period of time, because his services were so widely desired by people so that they could share kind of their specific experience of this area when they were sending postcards back home.
So the visual understanding that we have today could be credited to the postcard.
Yeah.
Done.
Thank you, Dick.
Okay. So that was Dick Himes. Mm-hmm. You mentioned Ross Hall, which, just for those who aren't familiar, was a famous photographer and kind of documentarian of the area from like the early 20th century.
The postcards mm-hmm. were a different form of advertising, and one that I personally think was probably more effective, because if you think of Wonderland or if you think of that diary, that was getting the word out to people back east, but for a pretty limited audience. The Wonderland train magazines were telling people about Sandpoint, but they were also telling people about all other different parts of the country. And again, that was a little bit more of a focused audience. The postcards were an organic way of getting the word out all over the place to all different kinds of people. There was no real method or strategy behind it, but I think word of mouth is still such a powerful mm-hmm. way to advertise or promote something. And this was basically a personal recommendation from someone to say, I've been here, it's great. If you get the opportunity, you should come too.
Yes. So we found this fascinating story in the papers, and I apologize, I don't have the date. It was early, and the title says, Dr. Wendell talks of how to get tourists. Suggests postcard idea at the noonday luncheon of the commercial club. Just setting the stage, there was the women of the Christian church who had a reputation for good things to eat. They were serving the food that day. I believe it was fried chicken. It had all the main players there. They were celebrating WCTU women's efforts on making sure that the men were not drinking alcohol, but drinking more water. And Dr. Floyd G. Wendell, he was of Danville, and he talked about how his friend Mr. Moody had, you know, contacted him through a postcard talking about all of the amazing things that Sandpoint had to offer. So then he started camping and exploring the wilderness and all of the amazing things that he had read about. And he thought that was such an effective strategy of communication that as they were trying to mastermind how do we get people to Sandpoint, he brought up that idea. And I just wanted to read a couple of quotes from the paper because it was so fascinating. So his idea was like, To find out the names of such men in a number of towns is comparably a simple matter. So you have essentially a list of names for the postal card with a scene of a lake or country that could be sent to each man. And the card could be addressed to familiar names such as Fred and then signed with like Bill or such other familiar names. The intimate nature of the appeal would arouse the man of curiosity, and he would wonder if he really knows you or not. And when he has received a second or third card after intervals of a few weeks, he is very apt to begin to investigate the country from which he is receiving these postcards with charming views and such alluring hunting and fishing scenes. Dr. Wendell read parts of a letter which he had received from Dr. Moody before he came to Sandpoint, in which the country was described in glowing terms, and he said the promises had been more than fulfilled. In closing, Dr. Wendell announced that he was going to start a sub-laboratory in this city, which would employ 12 to 15 people, mostly girls, and which, from the nature of the business, would give Sandpoint considerable advertising and increase the mail's, some of the paper from that time is a little hard to read, 50% within a year. In closing, Dr. Wendell offered his collection of 200 photographs for the use of the commercial club. And I was immediately like, where are those photos? So if you are a descendant of the Wendell family and you have amazing photos, please contact us. But Wendell talks about how much he appreciated, and then he kind of goes on to really kind of supporting this effort. There were 335 votes to make this happen, and it would be fascinating to find out how effective this scheme was. But I love the part about, you know, how he was, there was a little trickery involved in that, right?
Yes.
How creative.
Diabolical. What? So, sorry, he was going to start
a sub-laboratory.
What's a sub-laboratory?
I'm picturing...
He's already got a laboratory. This is a smaller... Okay.
Yeah.
Micro-lab.
Maniacal. Okay. So I imagine that was like a, what I would call like a work team today. The vernacular was so different back then.
I love, as you're reading this, I can't help but think of how people get so frazzled today about having their emails taken and sold to different companies, like advertising lists. And this is so the same tactic.
100%.
From over 100 years ago, where they're like, let's get the addresses of, what did it say, prominent people or like wealthy people, and we're going to pretend that we're their friends.
Uh-huh. I see, like, again, the curled mustache and, like, his hands are being folded. Like, sinister laugh.
It is exactly like, the first line in an email that you would get. Dear someone, name I know. Mm-hmm. Yes. It's been a long time.
Just click here.
Yeah, exactly. I heard about this great opportunity
I've been thinking about you.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
That perceived intimacy where you're like, do I know this person? Mm-hmm. What is going on? And you think of how many people fall for email scams today. I just love that he's so transparent about how he's going to prey on the, like,
be super possibly
poor memory or confusion of the people that they're reaching out to.
And they're all like, yes, you know, like 335 of them. Uh-huh. Brilliant Wendell, you know, the prominent doctor of the town.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think it goes to show, too, that was how important it was to focus on this and for the success of the community.
Mm-hmm.
You're listening to 88.5 KRFY. This is the Community Character Hour, where a once a month program about a number of things, including local history. And today we're kind of talking about boosterism and methods, some of them a little nefarious, of increasing the notoriety of Sandpoint in North Idaho in the early days of the 20th century. Heather Upton is the Arts, Culture, and Historic Preservation Officer of the City of Sandpoint, and Hannah Combs is the Executive Director of the Bonner County Historical Society and Museum. I'm Jack Peterson of KRFY. That's our little station identification. that's important to do from time to time. There you go. Let's let's talk now about, we've gone off on a number of different tangents, and I guess we're kind of veering off into kind of the less savory ways that people were trying to attract business to town. And unless there's anything, any reason not to, should we dive into a few more of those interesting stories?
Let's do it. This is the juicy stuff.
Okay. Who wants to take it away? What do we want to talk about?
So we just talked about our own community members trying to bamboozle those from abroad.
Yes.
I think it'd be fun to talk about a situation in which the tables were turned and the people of Sandpoint had the wool pulled over their eyes, if that's the right term for that.
Karma.
So this was a scheme pulled off by the Automobile Trailblazing Association. So a national organization. And the paper from 1914, 110 years ago, says A.L. Meigs, routing agent of the Automobile Trailblazing Association of America, sounds very official, is in the city today on his way from the east to Seattle. His business here pertains to mapping an automobile route from New York to Seattle. So cars were very new at this time and very exciting. Mm. It says, already an agent has traversed the route coming by way of Sandpoint. But it is understood that the people of Spokane are using their influence for the selection of a route by way of Coeur d'Alene, which would eliminate this city. And he had a whole, he said that they had a whole team of people who were out painting road signs. So you think of, you know, just like a little stake you might see by the side of the road. Theirs were painted red, and this was to show the preferred travel route from, all the way from, I want to say it was Minneapolis over to, or maybe Chicago, all the way over to, no, it was New York. Mm-hmm. I just said that. From New York all the way to Seattle.
Wow.
And this is a big deal. You know, as automobiles were becoming more popular and they were very exciting, you could travel on your own. You didn't have to depend on railroad schedule or things like that. So everyone wanted to be on this route because of all of the business that it would bring to town. Mm. If this was the one way that people were going to travel from east to west across the north of the country, they were going to come through Sandpoint, and this was a big deal. But as Meg said, they were the terrible people of Spokane were trying to undercut us and get it rerouted through Coeur d'Alene so that they could get all of the business. Mm-hmm. And the people of Sandpoint could not stand for that. So Meigs assured the people of Sandpoint that they were obviously the best choice and that he would not be cowed by the pressure from Spokane. And he would be an advocate for Sandpoint in this matter. So later that month, the commercial club signs a $50 contract.
Oh, that's a lot back then.
And think at this time, like multiply by about 30. So this is a good chunk of money that was supposed to pay for the blazing work. So for the people to come in, install the signs and paint them. And so then you don't hear anything about this for a long time. And in October of that same year, so about 6 months later, there's an ad in the or an article in the paper that says, "Con exposed." The newspaper in Mullen, Idaho, so this is down near Wallace, reports that Mullen, Wallace, and Coeur d'Alene had also all paid $40 to $60 for the red signs, which had been installed as promised. They said, "It is our belief that Sandpoint has been conwayed, but they don't know it as yet." But they were forced to pay the balance of the red paint trip through the Coeur d'Alene's. The city of Kalispell, Montana was similarly duped and never received red signs. So it's like they had chosen their route and... but they didn't have enough money to pay for it, or they just wanted more.
Yeah.
And so they traveled around to other towns in the region, promising that they would be on the route.
Right.
And getting them to pay up, and then never delivering.
How did that gentleman sleep at night?
I know. It's so grimy.
Mm-hmm. So grimy. So he just probably escaped back to New York.
Oh, yeah.
Like, quickly. Yeah.
Uh-huh. And it says, this was not the only con like this that happened. It says there was another one being put on by something called the Yellowstone Route Association. Oh. Now, they were different. They had yellow signs instead of red.
Do you think these were, like, nonprofits? Well, it sounds like actually they were for
I'm feeling they never filed any permits with anyone would be my my guess. But they...
I'm like, who allowed this?
Yeah. So that one only got as far as Missoula, but same type of scheme. It is interesting. It says these people got after cities on the routes, which would be the last to be chosen, as much on account of the distance as the impracticability of building roads. The Sandpoint route is fully 60 miles longer than the Mullen to Missoula road. So they're basically saying, why would Sandpoint ever believe that it would be on the best route? Our route is far more direct. And also at that time, I will say the roads around Sandpoint were terrible for probably a couple of decades. Everyone complained about how bad the roads were, and it was actually quite dangerous to travel by automobile.
Interestingly enough, and I have a friend who's probably in his like mid-50s, and he went to Gonzaga, and he lives in Oregon, and he talks about how there were dirt roads in the Tri-Cities, like going to school, like and that wasn't that long ago. So it's taken a while for infrastructure to be built over here.
Yes.
In the West.
I will say that I would personally defend the route going through Sandpoint because you don't have to go over any mountain passes if you were going from the West. I mean, if you were following the Clark Fork River up, you could go.
That's a good
point. You could go that way and then go down to Spokane, just like the railroad does.
Yeah.
You could do it.
That's true. If you also think about the highway, like especially through Laclede where all those cliffs were, are where they are. Yeah. I've seen photos of parts of that route, and it would be so easy to tip an old, like, Model T off the side of that road back in the day.
Such a bumpy ride with that early suspension as well, and the dust. I love, like, the goggles.
The
scarf.
So this was 1914 when this scheme came through town. This was before the adoption of the U.S. highway system, which it says here was not adopted till 1926, and probably partially to try and organize all of these competing ways of getting across the country that were people were just independently kind of trying to entrepreneurialize. Yeah.
It came from a good place initially.
Yeah.
Let's think.
Right. Anyway, so that's what's, that's that. Should we... I could try and play this this little musical interlude that we queued up. Should we do it? Okay. All right. We'll see if this works. Hang tight.
River City, next station stop. River City, next. Cash for the merchandise. Cash for the button hooks.
Cash for the cotton goods. Cash for the hard goods.
Cash for the fancy goods. Cash for the soft goods.
Cash for the nuggins and the piggins and the frickins.
Cash for the hogshead cask and jemmy jar.
Cash for the crackers and the pickles and the flypaper.
Look, what do you talk? What do you talk? What do you talk? What do you talk? What do you talk?
Where do you get it?
What do you talk?
You can talk, you can talk. You can bicker, you can talk. You can bicker, bicker, bicker. You can talk, you can talk. You can talk, 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 talk. Bicker, bicker, bicker. You can talk all you want, but it's different than it was.
No, it ain't. No, it ain't. But you gotta know the territory.
Why, it's the Model T Ford made the trouble, made the people wanna go, wanna get, wanna get up and go. 7, 8, 9, 10, 12, 14, 22, 23 miles to the county seat.
Yes, sir, yes, sir.
Who's gonna patronize a little bitty 2x4 kind of store anymore?
What do you talk? What do you talk?
What do you get it?
Not the Model T at all. Take a gander at the store, at the modern store, at the present day store, at the present day modern departmentalized grocery store.
What do you talk? What do you talk? What do you talk? What do you talk? What do you talk?
What do you get it?
What do you talk? What do you talk? What do you talk?
Where do you get it?
You can talk, you can bicker, you can
can talk, you can bicker, you can talk, 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 bicker, 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 you can talk all you want, but it's different than it was.
No, it ain't, but you gotta know the territory.
Why, it's a you need a biscuit made the trouble, you need a, you need a. Put the crackers in the package, the you need a biscuit in an airtight sanitary package made the Cracker Barrel obsolete, obsolete.
Obsolete, obsolete, obsolete.
Cracker Barrel went out the window with the mail pouch cut plug charmed by the stove. Changed the approach of the traveling salesman, made it pretty hard.
No, it didn't, no, it didn't, but you gotta know the territory.
Gone, gone, gone with the hogshead cask and demijohn, gone with the sugar barrel, pickle barrel, milk pan, gone with the tub and the pail and the tears.
Ever meet a fellow by the name of Hill?
Hill.
Hill.
Hill?
Hill?
Hill.
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 No!
Just a minute, just a minute, just a minute.
Never heard of any salesman, Hill.
No, he doesn't know the territory.
Doesn't know the territory.
What's the fella's line?
Never worries about his line.
Never worries about his line?
Or the Cracker Barrel being obsolete, or the you need a biscuit in an airtight sanitary package, or the Model T Ford.
Just a minute, just a minute, just a minute.
Never worries about his line.
Never worries about his line.
Or a doggone thing. He's just a bang beat, bell ringing, big hog, great gold, neck or nothing, rip roaring every time a bullseye salesman. That's Professor Harold Hill. Harold Hill,
tell us what's his line. What's his line?
He's a fake, and he doesn't know the territory.
What are you talking? What do you talk? What do you talk? What do you talk?
He's a music man.
He's a what?
He's a what? He's a music man, and he sells clarinets to the kids in the town with the big trombones and the rat-a-tat drums. Big brass bass, big brass bass. And the piccolo uniforms, too, with the shiny gold braid on the coat and a big red stripe running.
Well, I don't know much about bands, but I do know you can't make a living selling big trombones, no, sir. Mandolin picks, perhaps, and here and there a jew's harp.
No, the fella sells bands, boys' bands. I don't know how he does it. But he lives like a king, and he dallies, and he gathers, and he plucks, and he shines. And when the man dances, certainly, boys, what else? The piper pays him. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. When the man dances, certainly, boys, what else? The piper pays him.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
But he doesn't know the territory.
Wow. That was abrupt. You are listening to the Community Character Hour. That was the song Rock Island, which you may have noticed was kind of had a certain locomotion to it. That is the song that kicks off the music, the musical entitled The Music Man, which was a 1957 Broadway production. And I believe that's the original Broadway cast recording. You may be familiar with the 1962 movie based on the play. The reason we played that is because bands were kind of an important part of small town and big town life, of course, in the early part of the 20th century. Every town had to have a band. And in the movie, of course, that's the con man comes to town to try and swindle the townsfolk into buying instruments and uniforms for a band that he does not actually intend to start in town. But here in Sandpoint, did we have something analogous happen? Or what makes us think of the Music Man at this time?
Yeah, so the Music Man, as depicted in the play and in the musical and the film, is, I think, one of the most iconic cons ever depicted in, like, that sort of rural American landscape. And it set us on quite the rabbit down the quite the rabbit hole to see if anything like this had ever been played out in Sandpoint. So while I can't find anything about, like, an actual con happening with the local band, doing this research gave me a much better understanding of how someone like Harold Hill could come into a community and get away with something like that, and why this kind of con would have been so easy to pull off in a small town. So people in Sandpoint back in the early 1900s thought that having a band was a really important part of their identity as a community. In one of the first attempts I could find was in 1911, and I love this. It said Sandpoint musicians were starting their own band. It said, "The band will at all times be at the service of the city, and it is the intention of the band boys to be ready at all times to aid the different organizations of the city at times when band music is needed." And then it went on to say, all of them being old musicians, it will be but a short time until they will be giving weekly concerts on the streets. So I love that they think it's so important to have a band that they get all these retired guys together. They say, you're a band now, play music. These guys get really excited about it to the point that they're like, we're never going to be able to stop them. They're just going to be playing in the street. And I love that they make themselves so available. They're like, wake us up in the middle of the night. If something's going on, we will be there promptly with our instruments. Like, I cannot imagine something like this happening in the same way today, where it's unscheduled, just impromptu performances.
It's like parades in New Orleans.
Totally. Yeah. And so that was sort of the early organization of the idea of a band in Sandpoint. And then in terms of why having a band was so important in this concept of boosterism, a couple years later, it says that when they're sending off the band to a state performance, they say, we'd like to see them make a good showing for their own sake and for the good name and fame of the town. Mm-hmm. A few years later, they were considering starting a juvenile band. And it said, Sandpoint could have an organization famous throughout the entire Northwest. Looked at from a purely business standpoint, and not mentioning the immense impetus to the musical life of the town, the advertising and boosting resulting from such a band are impossible to calculate. So it's fascinating to me that this idea of having a town band was such a prominent part of their kind of marketing plan for the community.
I think we have our next episode potentially. Like, what are the other like town organizations that are out there promoting and advertising the town?
Yeah.
That's fascinating. So, I never knew that.
No. Yeah. And I was so delighted to find those very direct quotes about how the band was significant to boosterism, to marketing, and that they were conscious of that.
You have to find the photos.
Oh,
I would need to see the outfits.
I would love to. Well, speaking of outfits, and this is where the Music Man kind of comes into play. Some of the reasons why a con like that could take place is because it was apparently very expensive to have a community band. So you have to get instruments. There probably was not someone in town making tubas. So this would have to be ordered. I don't know if Sears and Roebuck did that and you could have it shipped in on the train or if it had to be specially delivered. But for example, Sandpoint eventually put together a military band and it was the only military band in the state. This was during World War I. So I'm curious if these were guys who like wanted to serve in the war but couldn't for some, you know, health reason or something like that. So this was another way they could contribute to the war effort. I don't know for sure. But we had a military band. However, it says it cost about $150 per month to run. The state would pay $25 of that, but that left $125 of the cost that the band members themselves had to pay. They had about 25 members of the band, so they were each paying $5 a month, but that would equate to about $150 a month today. So this was a big investment that they were paying themselves. The state was also not super reliable about the services it was supposedly providing to the band. So it says in 1912, the members of the militia band held band practice last evening. They used such instruments as could be secured around town, as the instruments furnished by the state have not arrived. Dr. O.F. Page, director of the militia band, received the bills for the instruments ordered this week. The cost of the instruments will amount to over $2,000. This would be about $60,000 today.
How?
This amount does not include the cost of uniforms and camping equipment. So, obviously, this is through the state. Like, you would hope that it's a legitimate thing, but it's also, like, that's a lot of money. And it doesn't seem like they're very reliable about getting them to them on time. So, it's probably just kind of, like, a logistics or, you know, getting through red tape kind of thing. But I can imagine if someone like Harold Hill came to town and said, hey, you don't want to deal with the state. I'm here to help you. I can get you those instruments really fast. And then there are later articles talking about how they don't have uniforms and trying to shame the community into like buying uniforms for them because the state won't send them. And so it's like opportunities like that are prime for people to come in and try to take advantage and
solve problems.
Yeah. Make false promises. They're like, oh, your band could be revered across the nation if you only had these premium uniforms that I'm offering you.
Yes.
That's really interesting.
Mm-hmm. The best looking band in the country. Before we wrap up the Community Character Hour, and we are growing close to the top of the hour, is there any other stories we need to squeeze in before we talk about other stuff?
Well, I just wanted to celebrate Dan Evans and Will Valentine again, because they're not here on the mic, but they're the power of research and discovering new information, which is so powerful and fun to be able to provide to everybody. And we just want to, again, remind everybody that we are actively, the Arts, Culture, and Historic Preservation Commission has a project called the Community Culture Campaign. And that's where we want to know your history. And this is in partnership with the museum. The museum is amazing, and they'll forever be archiving like your history. So we encourage people to contact us. And we're actually getting ready to do a call for information on residential history coming up. So please look for that. And we're going to start pushing that information out soon through all of our social media avenues. And then just another little city ditty. We have commissions and committees still open. We're closing in on Ped Bike. We've had quite a few applications for that. But all the other committees and commissions are open. And it's really important that we have the community involvement in the decision making of the future. And that's a great way to participate and be a part of future community planning. And so that's just on sandpointidaho.gov. Look under current events, and we want you.
What's going on at the museum these days?
Yeah, so we are going through the spring cleaning part of the year. Not for us, but for the community. This is the time of year when people are getting out of the house. They're realizing they have old stuff in the attic they want to clean up. And we are a place to bring those treasures to if they are connected to Bonner County history. We encourage you to bring them over. If you have something, we've had a number of pianos recently. So if you have something large like that, please give us a call or email us a photo first. If it's just little things, you can bring them in for us to look at. And we are always thrilled to be able to preserve and share objects and artifacts from the community. So, yeah, thanks for bringing those in. And we are processing them into the collection.
Okay. Well, what have we learned today? We have learned that the city of Sandpoint probably does, actually. I think this band idea, this idea of a band that you can just call at the drop of a hat.
Bring back the band.
Yeah. Right. Well, I think it should fall under your umbrella.
Oh, yeah. Let's do it.
I think you should establish there should be a 1-800, no, not like a, it should be not 411, not 911, 711.
For arts, culture, and historic preservation.
Yes, right to your cell phone, all hours of the day. And then
emergency band services.
Yes, emergency band.
My.
Yep.
That's going to, I used to play the trombone, so I might be able to dust that puppy off.
Okay.
See what happens.
All right. Well, tune in next month to see how that that develops. And actually, tune in next month. Can I say that we're probably talking about the city docks next month? Maybe. Is that yeah. That's possible?
Like tourism continued. Like what is so unique and special about Sandpoint, which goes into our community character?
Okay. I'm Jack Peterson. Heather Upton is the city arts, culture, and historic preservation officer for Sandpoint, Idaho. Hannah Combs is the executive director of the Bonner County Historical Society and Museum. This has been the Community Character Hour, and thank you for joining us this month, and tune in next month for more of this sort of information. This is 88.5 KRFY Pondere. Stay tuned for Bird Note and Otto's Eclectic Mix all day long after that.